Be Rad podcast is brought to you by MoFo, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone. Brad's macadamia masterpiece, mind-blowing nut butter blend, now offered on Amazon. Chili Technology, temperature-controlled mattress systems for a good night's sleep. InsideTracker.com, offering blood, DNA, and fitness tracking data all in one place. And Organifi, whole food organic superfood supplements and drink blends. And please visit the shopping page at bradkearns.com for my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance with great discounts for listeners. Here we go with the show.
I don't know that it's healthy for society to put health, attach it to like this size concept. I'm all for people like loving ourselves at any size, but being open to finding the size that both supports your health and your happiness. I realized that, you know, if you basically just ate protein, that it was very, very, very unlikely you would gain weight, and most likely you would lose weight. So I basically just ate protein for, I don't know, maybe like a year. And I don't recommend that, but I think it definitely speaks to the power of that macronutrient. If you're doing intuitive eating, listeners, and it's working for you, please do it. I wish I could do it the way it is presented. I think that'd be great, but it just, for me, I know what works and it doesn't work for me.
Hey, listeners, get ready for the powerhouse, Melanie Avalon. She is the host of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast, along with New York Times bestseller Jen Stevens, and the host of the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh, my goodness, we get deep into matters of eating, fasting, macronutrient ratios, and you're going to get some surprising and really memorable insights. One of them that comes to mind is how both low-carb, high-fat and a high-fat, low-carb approach can both work as long as you choose one or the other and stay away from those addictive, hyper-palatable foods that typically combine processed sugar and fat. So Melanie will set us straight with some really deep insights about all matters of losing excess body fat in a healthy manner, picking your macronutrients and your food choices and your eating windows wisely. And of course, we get finished with a little bit of biohacking stuff where she's talking about some interesting tidbits about making further breakthroughs and especially addressing the controversy about whether excess protein is dangerous and can restrict lifespan or increase risk of cancer. I think you're going to be illuminated by her commentary when you realize high fat, low carb, or low fat, high carb, the wars of the vegan versus the carnivore, primal paleo, ongoing forever and ever. But guess what the common theme is? And that's the emphasis on protein. You'll see how that is really effective, not only for fat loss, but for health and for satiety. A great show with fast moving insights from Melanie Avalon. Go check her out at the Intermittent Fasting Podcast and the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Melanie Avalon, I'm so excited to talk to you. We had our enthusiastic email introduction from other parties. I'm like, heck yeah, bring this girl on. How interesting, fascinating. You're all over the place, but mostly known, I suppose, as the expert in intermittent fasting and biohacking. Listeners, this girl is a powerhouse. She's got two podcasts, right? The Melanie Avalon the Intermittent Fasting Podcast and the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. So push pause for a second, go subscribe to both of those shows. And now we get her directly to hear what's all about. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And it's very exciting to talk to you because I've heard you in my head for so long. I want to say that you are one of the best audiobook narrators, in my opinion. And I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Like, you're incredible.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for that compliment. I'm going to like excerpt your little quip there and send it to the audio engineers who look at me through the glass going, dude, what the F are you doing? None of these words are on the script. What are you talking about? Because I figure if you're going to download an audiobook, I know you can read the exact book. I'm not going to be a robot and read it. Anyone can do that. So I have a tendency in the studio to go, You get what I'm saying here, people? It's kind of like when you're driving to McDonald's, like, you know, I'm just making something up. And then I go, okay, back to the script. Here we go. It's hard to stick to the script in life sometimes.
No, it cracks me up. And I want to read along with you to see like what you're adding and what is actually in the text.
Well, that's the poor guy's job. He has to make these little marks every time there's something that's not in the text. And okay, at least someone appreciates me. Thank you, Melanie.
I do. You're amazing. So thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, let's do like a little intro because I want to know how you got into those health specialties, and you also have this Hollywood career going in parallel. So, and then how you escaped from, I forget where it was in the South, and you jumped right into fast-paced academic and personal life. So let's get a little background.
Sure. So long story shortish. Yeah, I was raised in the South, moved to LA. But the whole dieting history, that's how I fell into the whole intermittent fasting world first out, and it came out of my diet struggles. So I was always trying lots of different diets to lose weight, like a lot of people are. So calorie counting, I did like the cookie diet, I did HCG drops, I did diet pills, I did all of the things. And then when I first tried low carb, that was the first time that something actually was effective. And then on top of that, I wasn't just losing weight. I experienced all these other health benefits that I did not anticipate. And then I became very intrigued and I was like, what is happening here? So I got really obsessed with the science of diet, and I first tried intermittent fasting as also an experiment. I was going to try it for 1 week, and this was about a decade ago, and I just never stopped because it was like that incredible. I started right from the get-go with the one meal a day approach. So I just was like, I'm not going to eat all day, and then I'll eat a huge dinner. And here we are now, like 10 years later. And then the third part of my dietary triad, I guess, was I found the paleo diet after reading Rob Wolf's book, The Paleo Solution. And that was kind of like the final piece of the puzzle with really finding the diet that works for me. My big thing is that there's no one right diet for everybody, but I originally self-published a book just to provide a resource for people because I would get so many questions all the time. Because I mean, intermittent fasting is a lot more popular now, but when I was doing it, nobody really knew what it was. So when I brought it up, people were very skeptical. So I was like, I'll just write a book and then I'll just give them the book when they have questions. So that was that. And then I started the podcast. I started the intermittent fasting podcast with my co-host, and she also had a book about intermittent fasting. So that was a great way to really like get out there. And ultimately started the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast because I started going on all the tangent health rabbit holes after having my own health challenges. And I just wanted a platform to, you know, all these books that I'm reading anyways, bring that to more people and interview the authors. And it's really wonderful. I'm really happy with everything.
You made it through all that frustration, confusion, struggles, which I'm sounding lighthearted, but for real, it's a really bad deal. And I'm especially pleased to be talking to a female expert because it helps to bring that new perspective in. And it seems like it's a real challenge with the societal forces, the cultural forces, the measuring, judging voices that we hear in the outside world that you can often succumb to. I believe you were heading to Hollywood to pursue the career in front of the camera. Is that right?
Yes.
So basically you show up here. I mean, it's cliche. Everyone knows these stories from the country girl heading to the big city, but you're very much measured and judged by your appearance. And so I'm wondering if you want to share, you know, how did that go hand in hand with what you describe as dietary struggles? I'm thinking you're not one of these reformed, obese people that lost 150 pounds, but more so trying to optimize and trying to get to that highest level where you get the part and someone else doesn't, you know?
Yeah, you really, touched on so many things. I never, I get that question a lot. Like, were you ever overweight or obese. And I was never overweight by conventional standard, like the standard, the BMI. I was never overweight BMI. But like you said, there is definitely a huge societal pressure, and especially in LA, a big pressure to be camera ready and to be a certain weight. And my
camera ready. I love that. That's a great line.
Yes. Oh yes.
I'm trying to be camera ready these days. Yeah. I'm no dessert for
it's
me. I'm going for camera ready. Yeah. I mean, it's typically used, where have I heard that line before? We need camera ready art for the ad campaign. Right. Now we're applying it to people. Whew.
Oh, I've never heard it applied to art. This
is
so interesting.
Camera ready. Yeah.
Yeah. Camera ready. So, to be camera ready, I honestly, all of those diets really were in pursuit of the camera readiness, and they were very restrictive and not fulfilling. And when I starting low carb and then starting intermittent fasting was just so eye-opening, because I finally could eat without restriction and not have all of that restrictive behavior. But still, I mean, made massive improvements in how I perceive my body. And I'm very much obsessed with the concept of body image. And because I know right now there's the whole health at any size. Mm. And I'm really intrigued by it, because I wish instead that it was like, love yourself at any size instead, because I think a lot of people can get locked. People might be unhealthy with their size, and actually unhealthy, like metabolically unhealthy, and following a diet that's not working for them, and probably feel really trapped in their bodies. I know, even though I was never crazy overweight, I felt trapped in my body as far as like sugar cravings and hunger and inflammation and brain fog and all of that. So I don't know that it's healthy for society to put health, attach it to like this size concept. I'm all for people like loving ourselves at any size, but being open to finding the size that both supports your health and your happiness. I know it's like controversial, but I think some people get like, they might be unhappy with the body that they're at, and they feel like they have to accept that because of culture today. Mm. When really they might be happier and healthier if they made changes. That's a little bit controversial.
Yes, you've navigated a very controversial issue. I appreciate that perspective a lot. It's so sensitive that you almost can't open your mouth without getting slapped from one direction or another, unless you're Joe Rogan and you're all powerful. And I've heard him say on a show on this very topic, like, if those people just get off their ass and quit being so lazy and all those kind of things. And then we have to reflect on Gary Taub's great book, Why We Get Fat, and his takeaway quote that gluttony and sloth are not the causes of obesity, they are the symptoms. So people with metabolic dysfunction, however you got there, whether you have some genetic predispositions or adverse dietary practices, you are going to be someone who is too tired to exercise and too hungry to stick to the diet that eliminates the foods that we don't want to eat. And so I think we have to have more compassion for people who are suffering from metabolic dysfunction. And it's not as simple as getting your ass off the couch and eating less food. Even though it is, we're going to have to back into that with healthy lifestyle practices. But boy, I think it's kind of a reactionary position to say healthy at any size, when if you're not healthy, you're not healthy, and you better wake up and take a look at this rather than cruise into, you know, seat number 14A because someone's reserving it for you, because we don't want to be politically incorrect or judgmental or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I just had Gary on my show as well. He's amazing. I loved his new book about the keto diet. A metaphor I just thought of, or simile, I guess it depends how I phrase it.
Don't ask me. I'm just a writer.
It's a simile. It's like, if there was a prison, this prison was being unhealthy, it's like if you were stuck in that prison because you're in an unhealthy state, but you're being told, no, you're healthy at any size. Like there is no prison. That would be very confusing and very frustrating because you might feel like there's nothing to do. Like you, I think it takes away some of that, the action that you can take to make, you know, to make changes.
Yeah. So. I mean, same with when people say everything in moderation, I like to fire back wise ass comment. This is a quote from Mark Twain, everything in moderation, including moderation. And when it comes to our eating choices, because we're bombarded with such garbage and such corporate propaganda and, you know, misleading advertising and all those things, we can't have a moderate approach to healthy eating. Otherwise, we're going to succumb and we're going to, you know, go into disease patterns that have touched and ruined so many people's lives and touched all of our lives. And so it's like, no, I have an extreme approach to my food choices because I have to navigate through all this poisonous, toxic shit that a lot of people are saying it's okay to eat or encouraging us to eat. So yeah, everything in moderation is going to get squashed. And I believe that, you know, there's a way to approach this issue in a sensitive way where maybe people can, you know, benefit from getting off their ass a little more and listening to Joe Rogan with, you know, a little bit of grain of salt. But boy, you know, we make good points here that, you know, don't give up if you're thinking along those terms.
Yeah, you're speaking to my heart. Because I do think there are different personality types, and I personally am an extremist. So I don't do so well with moderation anyways. I know some people do better with moderation, but that aside, like our processed foods that we have today, seeing as how they are basically genetically engineered to, you know, trick our brain into wanting more, I think it's really hard if people feel like they have to be able to engage with them in a moderationist approach, if we're going to continue walking on tiptoes, like with the intuitive eating movement, I think, I'm all for intuitive eating. I think it's really hard for a lot of people with today's food. And I don't know that I could intuitively eat like a lot of things. Like, I don't know if that means I'm like I'm bad at intuitive eating, or if it just means that certain foods you can't really be intuitive with because they're not working with your body intuitively. Yes.
Yeah. I'd like to hit on that a little more because I think the personality type is probably something that we should apply more rather than, you know, I've had one guest on saying one thing and another guest on saying another thing. One of them said, you know, certified dietitian, where they don't want to directly tell the person, don't eat all that ice cream. They say, eat a spoonful and therefore you won't obsess about it and you'll be rewarded. You're just going to keep it under control. And I'm like, well, I'm not sure that's a blanket approach that's going to fit everybody. One of my shows, Melanie, is called The Fatty Popcorn Boy Saga. And it's a story about me where I started making bowls of popcorn at night for fun and celebration. I think visiting family and holiday times, and here's another bowl, and I drizzle lemon flavored olive oil on it. It's fantastic. And so it went from a celebratory treat to a regular fixture in my evening routine because I was starting to build a habit in the wrong direction. And all of a sudden I discovered a higher number on the scale than, you know, my reference point is my driver's license. I've had the same weight for 30 years or whatever. And all of a sudden it's like, wait, that's not me. What's going on here? And so you can go down this slippery slope, especially with the hyper palatable addictive foods, to the extent that maybe the suggestion to just enjoy one spoonful of ice cream a night, that might work for 23.8% of the population. It might be a disaster for you and I and another 25% who, you know, need to have more discipline and structure to where it's not even a decision. It's like the peanuts on the airplane where you're offering to the person with a peanut allergy and they say, no, thank you. They don't go, well, it's a long flight. Maybe I'll try a few. It's not even a thought or a decision. And I kind of like that approach when we have so many challenges that we're facing with, the processed foods.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And like you said, like I said, and you said, I do think it comes down a lot to your personality and how you react. But I feel like there's such a pressure especially with intuitive eating, it's like, oh, if you can't have, like you said, you know, that one bite of ice cream, like if you can't and without wanting more and like feeling worse from that, then it's like you failed at being intuitive, when maybe your intuition, which is not to have any. And that might be healthier for you in the long term. But again, if you're doing intuitive eating, listeners, and it's working for you, please do it. I wish I could do it the way it is presented. I think that'd be great. But it just, for me, I know what works and it doesn't work for me. I feel more free with boundaries that I work within.
Eliud Kipchoge just won the Olympic gold in the marathon for the second Olympics in the row, the greatest marathon runner of all times. And he also is this super quotable athlete. He comes up with these beautiful one-liners. And one of the things he said that's repeated a lot in the running scene is only the disciplined ones in life are free. Otherwise, you become a slave to your whims and passions. And I think they're asking him, how can you train that hard every single day? You know, the guy runs 20 miles every day of his life, and he feels free and free to enjoy his life because of all the discipline and structure. And I think creating the winning environment is a huge deal, where you don't have to cultivate intuition or not, because there's no ice cream in your freezer. So it's a done deal. It's over. Whereas you think about it differently. Lindsay Taylor, who we work with at Primal, she says, you know, if there's a plate of cookies sitting out in your house, it's going to be a little different than if there's no cookies around. Same with if there's a kettlebell sitting in plain view. We want it in plain view in our visual field all day long. We're going to be very much more likely to lift that kettlebell and do a few swings rather than if it's in a cupboard, you know, out of view. So when it comes to food, oh my gosh, when you're shopping, that's probably when you're really under the gun, and that's where, you know, you're going to do a make or break your goals.
I could not agree more. That's an epic quote about the discipline. It's kind of like I have noticed this so much ever since I learned it. I've really realized just how true it is. But basically, because, you know, they say when you're starting a new diet to just, you know, clear out the fridge and clear out the freezer of whatever you don't want to be having on your new diet. If your brain knows that there is access to something that is tempting to it that you don't want to have, it'll keep trying to find it.
Driving down the street to get cigarettes. You know, everyone's familiar with that notion where, you know, the house is free, but you can get in your car and drive 6 minutes down to the convenience store. Oof.
Yeah.
It's rough. Yeah.
Yeah. But even just like having something in your cupboard that you don't have on your plan, as long as it's there, your brain will most likely, you know, try to find a way to get it. I'm for setting up your environment and your life to work with your willpower and not drain it during the day.
Rewind the tape, people. That's a great one. Right. You know, we're going to drain our willpower, or we're going to kind of keep it at bay because there's no willpower necessary.
Exactly. Which, with intermittent fasting, I think that's one of the most freeing things that people don't really realize until they try it, which is the amount of decisions you don't have to make anymore because you just around food. So you just, you know, decide your window that you're eating in, and then you're just, it's not even a question. You're not eating outside of that. So you're not having to engage in those constant, should I eat? Should I have a snack? Should I stop eating? Should I, like, just all day. You just eat in your window, or maybe eat your two meals in your window, like your book. and then you're good.
So you said what works for you is this one meal a day where you can be free and unrestrained when it's time to eat. I imagine you're not counting calories when you sit down for your first meal, and you're saying that you've carried that through for a long time. That's your favorite pattern.
Yeah. So I've been doing the quote one meal a day. It normally ends up being about 4 hours. What I've found that works for me personally, because again, I'm all about what works for the individual, is for me, I found the most beneficial thing for either losing weight or maintaining my body composition and also not exacerbating any metabolic issues is to do either low carb, potentially high fat, but low carb or high fat, low carb. So I will do one or the other. So there's always, it's always high protein. It's always a lot of protein. And then I either do fat or I do carbs. Usually it's carbs actually, which I normally do a ton and ton of fruit.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there's a lot of support for this idea now that the pairing of fat and carbs, which is unknown to nature or ancestral diet, is what triggers us. And that's, if you can name the top 50 comfort foods, indulgent foods, they're usually pairing fat, carbs, and salt together, cheesecake, ice cream, potato chips, whatever. And, you know, we kind of get stuck in this idea that you're a low carb ancestral person, or you're a vegan plant-based, and it's going to be a war forever. But what you just said, I think kind of hopefully will put a lot of people at ease who are wondering, you know, who's right and who's wrong and who's smarter than the other person. But making one or the other choice, you're going to get that satiety that you are looking for from mostly from the protein. And then perhaps from enjoying a ton of fruit. It's, you know, at a certain point, you're not going to overeat on fruit, nor are you going to overeat on high fat, completely savory treats. But boy, putting them together with the blueberry cheesecake, that could be a whole different story.
Yeah. And I've thought about this a lot, especially because on the Intermittent Fasting podcast, we get so many questions from listeners who a lot of them are doing low carb or keto and fasting, and they're terrified of carbs. Like, they think that the only way that they can lose weight or maintain their weight is being low carb. And I think one of the biggest kind of mind blown moments to, or like mind blown paradigm shifts to think about, is if you're eating low fat, and I say it so like nervously, but I just think like low fat in the paleo keto world is kind of frowned upon. But if you're eating low fat, you know, high protein with carbs, especially in a fasting window, like the potential for fat storage actually isn't that huge. So protein doesn't easily become fat. It's normal, you know, it's mostly used for building our bodies. And then if it's turned into some fuel, maybe like gluconeogenesis, some glucose there, it's rarely turned into fat. Carbs, you know, are first going to fill up our glycogen stores. So that's a big sink for them. And then after that, they can be turned to fat, but it's a very small percent relative to like the potential for it, at least in the clinical trials on it. So like the carb to fat, like people say, oh, excess carbs turn to fat. They do, but it's not as much that as you just store the fat that you're eating with the carbs. So if you're actually doing like a low fat, high protein, high carb diet, especially in a fasting window, I actually find it's pretty hard. It would be hard to gain fat doing that. And if anything, you might lose weight. And I think a lot of our listeners will be doing, you know, low carb for so long, and then we present this idea, and then they try it and are very surprised.
They're very surprised at the results. I mean, good results. This is pretty heavy stuff, Melanie. You're on the cutting edge here, and I'm wondering if there's anyone out there who's recoiling a little from this crazy idea that a high carbs are not going to be stored as fat. I think it's a good time now to open up the umbrella that covers everything over here, really nicely described by Dr. Herman Ponser in his new book, Burn. And I had a couple interviews with him. The second interview being a full length devil's advocate hammering on this guy to make sure he knew what he was talking about. It's look, this is my life's work, people. The science doesn't lie. We know how many calories people burn. But the amazing takeaway insight from his life's work, his research, Duke University evolutionary anthropologist, is that human calorie burning is constrained. We burn around the same number of calories each day, whether we exercise or not, end quote. And so if that's the case, then whatever calories you eat, it really is whether you're going to eat more or burn more and eat too much. And whether it's carbs or fat is completely irrelevant. And he mentioned this guy on the Twinkie diet. I don't know if you've heard of that, but mm-hmm. he was an actual scientist guy who said, here's how much I weigh, and here's how many Twinkies I'm going to eat. And he, you know, recorded everything, and he lost a ton of weight because he only ate 4 Twinkies a day. And so he had this caloric deficit, not saying it's healthy, not saying it's recommended, but it does put into light, or kind of negate some of this crazy, you know, hip commentary that there's a way to hack this that's away from actual metabolic science. And so what you're saying is accurate, period. And if you don't like that, people, you know, maybe try eating in a narrow eating window and having a bunch of fruit, and you'd be surprised at your results.
Well, actually, can I tell you what I think is also related to this? What I think is one of the other most mind-blowing things and misconceptions in the low-carb world about
bring
all
it,
of this.
Girl.
So people often in the low-carb world think, we know that fat doesn't elicit a huge insulin response. So the thought from that is, okay, fat doesn't release insulin, so I can have a lot of fat and I won't gain weight from it. When really, I think the reason it doesn't elicit a huge insulin response is because it is so easily stored without insulin. So the complete opposite takeaway that you could have extracted from this fact is that eating fat is actually very easily stored as fat, not the opposite. And I just think that's one of the like biggest paradigm shifts for low carb, the low carb world.
Dr. Kate Shanahan says that anything you eat will elicit some insulin response. We know that protein stimulates insulin and also stimulates glucagon, so you don't have the insulin spike as much as eating straight carbs. But even a snack that's high in fat is going to shut off the burning of stored body fat, stimulate an insulin response. And then what are you going to do with those calories? Maybe you'll burn them, but like you say, fatty acids are in good molecular shape to go right into storage, convert into triglycerides. So now we're kind of getting over, drifting over with the conversation into this idea of intermittent fasting as being as important, maybe more important than nitpicking your macros and pricking your finger until you get scar tissue about how your ketone levels are. Just quit eating so frickin' frequently and snacking all day long. So I'm going to tee you up in that direction to go deeper into this intermittent fasting concept.
Yeah, sure. So intermittent fasting, I think it gets rid of all of the issues, or so if you're eating all throughout the day, there's just, you have to have this whole dialogue of insulin release and am I fat storing, am I fat releasing, it, you know, what is my meal doing. Intermittent fasting just like short circuits, just goes all straight around that, because once you do enter the fasted state, I mean, there is no other option. You have to pull fuel from somewhere. So, and that can seem like an extremist approach to things, but as you know, and probably a lot of listeners know, because you do enter a fat burning state and potentially a ketogenic state, you are filled with fuel from within. So you're not hungry, or you shouldn't be once you adjust to it. So, yeah. And I've actually thought, and tying it back into what we were saying about the different macronutrients, I've thought about this a lot, and it's an interesting dichotomy to picture to paint, and I'm not sure if I can articulate it, but I think about this a lot. So if you are on a low carb diet, you know, you're keeping insulin low. So it's going to be very easy, or it's going to be easy to release your fat stores. So it's pretty easy to burn fat. But then, as mentioned, with the fat storage potential of fat, and fat being a really easy macronutrient to store, I think it's actually at the same time very, very easy to store fat from your meals, because fat is easily stored. So easy to burn fat, but also easy to store fat. On the flip side, with like a high carb diet, a high carb, low fat diet coupled with fasting, so it's going to be less easy to burn fat, because you might because of the carbs, keeping your storage in storage. But then when you eat, as we mentioned with those macros, it's actually unlikely to store fat from it. So you have a situation now where maybe it's less likely to burn fat, but also less likely to store fat. I don't know if this is a dichotomy worth contemplating, but I actually contemplate it a lot. And I think you can get the best of both worlds by either doing low carb, but not going super, if you're wanting to lose weight, going low carb, but not going super crazy high fat. Mm-hmm. So now you're in the fat burning mode, but you don't have to worry as much about the fat storage from the fat. Or with the high carb, low fat approach, you're not going to easily store fat from eating. So coupling it with fasting, now you're getting your fat burning potential from there. So that's why I think that the fasting with, for a lot of people, the higher carb approach can actually work pretty well. Higher carb, lower fat. Mm-hmm. It was meandery. I think about this a lot, though.
Yeah, there are a couple of follow-ups. And one of them is that we weather a fair amount of opposition from the female voice that the fasting can be a little trouble, or the intermittent, the window, due to female hormonal patterns, striving for reproductive fitness, our number one biological drive, especially fit females. And so I've seen some direct commentary saying, don't try this if you're a fit female. I wonder if you've kind of been hit with some of those objections to the recommendation to spend a lot of time fasted.
Yes, a lot of questions. And first of all, not a doctor. I'm very much about.
So that means you know a lot about nutrition, I guess.
Very funny.
No offense, doctors, but get any training in nutrition? Not necessarily would be the correct answer. And some actresses don't know shit about nutrition, and some of them know a lot because they study it. So I think I like to put a little commercial in here for the idea that, we're looking at people's credentials constantly, or trying to grab onto something that make them seem like an authority. And when it comes to athletics or fitness, I like people who have been there and done that. So some guy on a YouTube video or gal who's got a six pack, they probably know what they're doing in some way because they're doing it in their own life. And same with nutrition. If you've been living and breathing his stuff, I think you have way more credibility than some doctor who probably speaks out of turn more frequently than they should because they don't necessarily know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I'm all for empowering people to, take things into their own hands. And like Google Scholar is like my favorite thing in the world. I just love, like, you can read all of the studies that the same things that the doctors would be reading. You can read it. And then you can implement things in your life and see how they actually manifest. So yes, we are on the same page there. But as far as the female aspect goes, to start, I think the majority of the backlash against fasting for women, there's not a lot of clinical literature in human females showing the issues. So the majority of the studies showing problems with females specifically in fasting are conducted in rodents. And one of the largest or one of the biggest problems in my opinion for why this is problematic is fasting in a rodent is like, so a 24-hour fast in a rodent is the equivalent of days and days and days in a human. So all of these studies looking at, 24-hour fast in a rodent, that's like fasting for days. And the rodent reproductive cycle is much more sensitive to restriction and dietary fluctuations than a human. So I don't know how much of the information from the rodent studies we can extrapolate to female women. The studies that do look at women and fasting often find a lot of really good effects for women, even things hormonal like PCOS and things like that. granted, most of them are in women that are overweight. And I think where the issue comes in, because I do think an issue very easily comes in with women and fasting. So I was building all that up not to say, oh, fasting is completely fine for women all the time. I actually don't think that. I think, I don't think fasting by itself is necessarily restrictive, but I think it can easily become restrictive if you make it so. And if it's coupled with dietary restriction, which a lot of women do, either on purpose or not on purpose, and or intense exercise, I think it can easily become too restrictive. It can be just, it can compound. So I don't think it's necessarily the fasting that's the issue. I think that it's really important to look at your entire lifestyle and what signal are you sending to your body with the fasting, the food, and the exercise.
Ooh, I like that little throw in at the end. Yes. If you're training like an idiot doing CrossFit 5 days a week, you're going to go onto the internet and start criticizing fasting. But we got to go look at everything for sure. Yeah. And in fact, I guess I should pose this as a question to you during the Ask Melanie section of the show. But I like this idea of personal experimentation, and I do a lot of it myself. So I'm, you know, I can't be pigeonholed into this is how I eat every single day. I'm on the 16 and 8 pattern forever. So things change. And I kind of, adding up these, compounding, like you call it, where I'm trying to do these super ambitious sprinting and jumping workouts that are really strenuous. So that's one, if you're counting. Number two, I'm in the older age groups now, which I kind of refuse to believe, but then I acknowledge when I get home and feel fried after pushing myself too hard in the workout. So I'm in the older age group. I'm trying to do crazy workouts, and I eat really cleanly. I don't, you know, mess around with overeating and whatnot. So perhaps my carbohydrate intake is on the low side, and, you know, my caloric intake is on the optimal side. But at times, if you're talking about, you know, fasting window, eating the cleanest foods, the most calorically efficient foods, and trying to do crazy stuff and being older age group, my insight at one point was like, what if I came home and, you know, stuffed the blender full of an incredible smoothie with all kinds of calories, carbs, protein, fat, whatever it is, in the interest of recovering? And so maybe there's not too many people in this category that have too many stress factors, because we know that fasting is a stressor in itself, and the body has to kick in stress hormones into the bloodstream to liberate energy into the bloodstream and all that great stuff. And that's all fine and dandy. If you're sitting at work, you're going to be concentrating and feeling great. But what about when you're, I don't know, in a stressful 16-hour movie shoot where you're maybe not going hand in hand with not eating any food?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a difference in the context, because, you know, people, I love what you said, like people who are, you know, doing, which is amazing, but doing like really, really intense CrossFit, you know, every single day. I think for them, you know, fasting very likely a lot of the time might be too stressful. That doesn't mean that it does not mean that fasting by itself is equates restriction, like for like over restriction. So I think it's when you move from restriction to over restriction. So
yeah.
And then I was gonna say, I do think women, so because men could be over restrictive as well, obviously, like you were just talking about. I do think that said, when you hit that over restrictive paradigm or like way of being, that women's bodies are more sensitive to it hormonally. So
message to the females listening who are at their optimal body composition. Are they in a different category, decision-making category or something where we don't want to get lower than necessary body fat and throw off reproductive function or other downstream thyroid? Everyone talks about the thyroid slowing down. What do you think about that?
So like, oh, so is the question like, if you're optimal, is it safe to fast, or does fasting like, I think if you're at your, you know, the body that you want to be at, you want to maintain, it's optimal, you know? You can 100% find a fasting window that works for you. And if it's a situation,
which might be a small one, I mean, it might be 12 hours, right?
Right. So you might need a longer window. You might need to eat more in a shorter window. Like I'm not actively losing weight. I just maintain my weight. I still eat usually and have been eating like a 4-hour window, but I eat a lot in that window. Mm-hmm. So you really just have to look at yourself. If the question is there a body composition where you just can't fast? I mean, I think if you're underweight to the point of being like where you actively need to gain weight, that might be an exception.
Sure. So. It also seems like if you are carrying excess body fat, you're frustrated with your past efforts to remove that excess body fat. Maybe you have a different set of decision-making parameters than someone who is at optimal body fat, where there's not going to be this intuitive backdoor answer to be like, sure, don't fast that long because you're cranky in the morning if you don't eat a huge sugary breakfast. I mean, that's probably a safe assumption to say, look, if you need to get rid of excess body fat, let's throw these tools into place.
Yeah. And actually, speaking to that, can I do a quick plug for your new book? Two meals a day, people. I really liked the chapter. I don't know if it was, I was listening, so it's hard to know if it was like a section or a chapter, but I really liked the part you guys had, a part about, you know, hacks to, you know, really
advanced strategies.
Yeah. I thought that was quite excellent. And I thought it was great because it's things that might be perceived to stay in the like, controversial waters, things that might be perceived as culturally, you know, too restrictive or too extreme. But I think these are very valid tools that we can use to, depending on what your goals are and what you want. I don't think there's anything wrong with desiring a certain body composition and, you know, utilizing smart tool. Like there are healthy ways. Well, there are healthy advanced strategy ways to get there compared to just completely unhealthy lifestyle approaches that just might wreck you. So right. I appreciated that section.
Thank you. Appreciate that. If you're listening carefully, you notice, especially when you're talking about the dichotomies and the different things, the common theme running through is that emphasis on protein. So I'd love to touch on that. Especially with your results and experience tiptoeing on both sides of the tightrope, but always having protein as the fixture.
Yes, protein is my obsession. I actually yesterday interviewed Dr. David Menkoff. He wrote a book called The Perfect Protein, I think. And it was my first, I've had Dr. Ted Naiman on the show and we went deep in protein there, but the show this week was like the deepest of deep dives into amino acids and protein. And it was really, really excellent. But I just think I am haunted. Oh, going back to the dichotomy, I am haunted. I'm haunted because on the one hand, there are a lot of advocates of low protein diets for health and longevity, particularly in the vegan world and even the fasting world, like Dr. Walter Longo. And then on the flip side, we have people who are very, very pro protein. It haunts me, but my thoughts on the matter are when it comes to the different macronutrients, especially body composition, weight loss, health, so many things, like protein is the magic macronutrient for that. It's what builds your body. It's highest correlation to satiety. You know, has a good thermogenic effect. So you're burning more calories eating it than the other macronutrients. So lower protein intakes are correlated to longevity up until a certain age, but then once you hit a certain age, that correlation disappears and you actually need higher protein intakes, which I think is very telling for the role that it's doing in our bodies. So especially since when our bodies are aging, the fact that we now need more protein, I think, is pretty telling. But I do think that diets aside, focusing on protein is, in my opinion, probably the place to focus. I do think that for the longevity aspect, because people will say you should do low protein because it doesn't stimulate mTOR as much and it's anti-aging. But I think you can get those benefits if you, you know, combine it with fasting, for example, because then you're going into a, you know, a period of no mTOR during the day. And also mitigating things like IGF-1. So I'm a fan of protein.
Yeah, I love it. Your opinion here is supported by many of the world's leading experts. I particularly appreciate how there's been some backlash against this black and white thinking of saying, eat less protein, downregulate these growth factors. If you're not familiar with IGF-1 or mTOR, these are the stated agents that if you overstimulate them by stuffing your face with too much food your whole life, it's going to increase your risk for cancer and unregulated cell growth. But now we're coming to our senses a little bit more, saying, look, we know that getting minimal protein is absolutely essential, and dabbling in restricting protein is going to turn you into a mess. You're going to be cranky, emaciated, experiencing intense cravings for high protein foods. This is from Dr. Chris Kresser spreading this message that we don't want to go mess around with low protein diet. And then when we talk about getting as much as we need or more, there's a lot of benefits toward pushing that number, like Dr. Ted says so well too, the protein to energy ratio in the diet. For one thing, it's difficult to overconsume protein because, I don't know, raise your hand if you've ever eaten too many omelets and feel terrible at the breakfast bar, or had two steaks and then I wish I wouldn't have that third. No, it's so satiating that you're going to eat just as much as you need. And if you're getting plenty, what you just mentioned of turning on and off those growth factors, that's the secret to longevity. You can listen to Dr. Peter Attia go deep on this matter, but mTOR and IGF-1 are not all the way around bad guys, nor is insulin. And this is what helps us preserve muscle mass. I took a great quote from Rob Wolf interview where he said, hey, if you want to live longer, it's looking now that you want to lift more weights and eat more protein, rather than walk around weak and emaciated. And people tease, you know, the long-term vegans of looking like they're shriveled up and about to blow away in the wind. I don't need to be, dramatic here. But this is a big one for many people who are maybe feeling a little confused about people, you know, blanket statement that you don't want to eat too much protein or big dangers occur. Oh, and finally, since I'm rambling so long, Melanie's having a lunch over there, a high protein thing, but the thermic effect of protein has been measured at 25%, which means 25% of the protein calories you consume go toward digesting that protein. So again, you're not going to overeat protein and get yourself into a bind of gaining weight or anything like that, because it's so essential to the body. Sisson says don't even count it in your calorie count because it's sort of irrelevant to your fat loss goals or if you are tracking macros.
Yeah, actually, and I'm not promoting this, and I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit it, but probably the first, like the biggest weight loss chunk I experienced was when I had during my dietary experimentation days, but being low carb and after fasting, I realized that, you know, if you basically just ate protein, that it was very, very, very unlikely you would gain weight, and most likely you would lose weight. So I basically just ate protein for, I don't know, maybe like a year. And I don't recommend that, but I think it definitely speaks to the power of that macronutrient. It's also kind of like the alcohol macronutrient. People often think that, you know, you gain weight from alcohol, but you're not gaining weight from alcohol. Alcohol doesn't become fat. Like, it just doesn't. So
right.
You're gaining weight from whatever you ate with that.
Yeah. Quick lesson. Alcohol is burned immediately. It doesn't convert to anything. It's immediately burned. Otherwise, you're going to die, right? And so what happens is it puts the burning of all the other calories on hold, such that, especially removing it from the bloodstream. So you're going to get a drop in blood sugar and you're going to crave the pizza and the other things that are going to cause you to gain weight from your alcohol habit, or a mixed drink where you're consuming the carbohydrates. Those can't be burned because the margarita has to be burned first. And so where they're going to go, they're going to get stored as fat.
Yeah, exactly. So,
back to your secret commentary that a high protein diet works for fat loss. I think it's important to talk straight about these things because, to me, clearly that's the most effective strategy to drop excess body fat and do it quickly and efficiently. And I think that's why, a lot of the reason why the carnivore diet has exploded in popularity is it's by default a very high protein, high nutrient density, high satiety diet, which you have no problem sticking to, and the fat is going to melt off like no other diet. Now there's this concept called rabbit starvation and these weird things that happen if you eat only protein. So just as Melanie qualified her statement, don't eat just protein or you're going to get into weird potential stuff. But I think most people, you can't help but you're going to add a sufficient number of carbs or fat to get you to a place where you feel good, you're dropping excess body fat, and you have no problem sticking to the diet as long as necessary.
Yeah. And actually to that point, I'm not for crash dieting, but I think if one were to crash diet, like if they had to lose a,
if one landed a huge movie role and they say, we need you to get in shape. Yeah.
Yes. Or they had like a wedding in 10 days. Well, wedding, they're probably no longer about than 10 days, like a short time period. I do think the healthiest way to lose fat quickly is the protein sparing modified fast that people do, where basically they're eating calorie restricted, but it's basically just protein. Mm-hmm. Because then you're supporting your minimal body functions and your muscle, but it's just your body has to turn to fat for fat burning. Not meant to be long term, but I do think it just speaks to the science of how protein is used in the body and how you can maybe use that to your advantage if you needed to. But again, that's not meant to be long-term.
This show is, I'm enjoying it because I didn't know there was that much to talk about. I feel like we were talking before we hit record about the book writing process and how arduous it is to start with a blank page and finish with 347 pages of talking about eating strategies and ancestral living. And whenever I'm done, Mark and I talk on the phone and we say, man, I don't think there's anything more we can say, but Melanie's just loaded us with interesting insights and there's a lot more to say. So I encourage people to go flip over to your podcast on intermittent fasting. We're definitely going to have to have you back to talk about the other side of the coin. So maybe just give us a little a teaser about what's your favorite stuff in the biohacking world and what you talk about on that show.
Oh goodness. So the biohacking world is the rabbit holes of rabbit holes of rabbit holes, but it's basically all of the technologies, supplements, lifestyle things that you can do in your daily life to upgrade your body's performance. I actually think it's using modern technology to return to what we once were. It's like using technology to tackle your light exposure. So blue light blocking glasses, red light therapy, making our modern homeostatic environment actually more difficult. So doing cryotherapy or saunas, it can even go as crazy. My recent obsessions, this whole time I've been drinking deuterium depleted water. That is a rabbit hole to go on. It's either like the most important thing ever or not, but I think it might be the most important thing ever. Mitigating EMF, using different modalities for like meditation. So rather than just normal meditation, it might be like, Wim Hof breathing or meditation devices like Muse, or I got this device called Core that you hold in your hands and it vibrates. Mm. It's basically, all of the crazy things that you can do in your daily life to hopefully enhance your experience of life, make you feel healthier, and like I mentioned, really just combating our modern environment, because our modern environment is just not ideal, not ideal.
Well said. I like that. And I like going back to the basics, lest anyone get confused or overwhelmed. And so before you go into your red light box or your sauna or your chest freezer, you know, let's make sure that like these big picture items that are so easy to just transition away from, but we're still blasting our eyeballs, you know, with light late at night. Maybe reading an interesting article about the benefits of red light therapy for mitochondria. But in my own personal life, I'm really trying to just, if I can just put some rules into place that give me a fighting chance to go pursuing rabbit hole optimization things, that's what's fun. And I know you and I are both fans of people like Ben Greenfield and Peter Attia and people pushing out on the cutting edge. But when I interact with real people, like my buddies from high school, and we're talking about this or that, and someone sticks a plate of nachos in my face, says, Brad, is this healthy or not? Yes or no? You know, they want like a quick answer and just things to carry with them so they can at least have a fighting chance. And so I'm really thinking we don't want to skip over any of those steps. But then, oh my gosh, isn't it fun and exciting to, you know, address all these different ways? And I've never quite heard it put that way, where, you know, we think about this concept of becoming superhuman and having incredible energy, but it's really like all you want us to do is get back to general baseline human expectation, rather than being a sorry ass modern human that's getting bombarded with all this stuff that's compromising our energy.
Yeah, I just think we as human beings, like, we have all of the potential and the energy and the joy and the love all inside of us. It's just very much hampered and dampened by our chronic lifestyle today. So just starting there, undoing what has been done, it can take you to a huge, incredible place.
Dave Rossi, my good friend, frequent podcast guest, author of The Imperative Habit, very spiritual guy, teaches a meditation course online. And you know what his secret is for happiness?
I do not.
Get rid of all the stuff that makes you unhappy. And what you have left is this inherent happiness. It's a great concept.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. Yeah, it's like Dorothy. It's always in your own backyard. All along.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho's best-selling book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Melanie Avalon, killing it. People, go listen to Intermittent Fasting podcasts. Listen to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking podcast. I appreciate you spending time with us. We got way more than we bargained for. It was hard-hitting, heavy-hitting. We're going to have to listen to this at 1.0 speed instead of the usual 1.5 or the 1.75 speed, because there are so many insights to pull out, and it was always interesting.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Brad. I've been such a fan of your work for so, so long. So this is just like the biggest honor ever. And you are just, I've barely met you, but you just have the most amazing spirit. It comes across in your work, your podcast, your books, everything. You're doing incredible things. So I'm honored to be here.
Thank you, Melanie. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.